The Center for Biblical and Theological Education presents Lectio, Guided Bible Reading. All guided Bible readings are the property of Seattle Pacific University. For copyright information or to learn more about the Center for Biblical and Theological Education, please visit www.spu.edu/CBTE. Seattle Pacific University, engaging the culture, changing the world through the power of God's Word.
Called to be humble servants. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 5 through chapter 4, verse 21. In this week's Lectio passage, Paul completes his lengthy opening response to the problem of factions within the Corinthian church. Recall that Paul is responding to a report that Corinthian believers were aligning themselves with different leaders in the church, playing the game of, my leader is better than your leader. Paul's message has been simple. Divisions based on a prideful desire for status and power are signs of foolishness, not signs of cross-centered, godly wisdom. In today's passage, Paul first shows the Corinthians a wiser way to see leadership roles in the church in chapter 3, verses 5 through 23. He then applies this perspective to his ministry in chapter 4, verses 1 through 13. And finally, Paul makes a fatherly plea for the Corinthians to change their ways in chapter 4, verses 14 through 21. Let's examine each of these three sections. In our first section, chapter 3, verses 5 through 23, Paul offers the Corinthians a better way to see leadership roles. Our second lectio, 1 Corinthians 1, 10 through 2, 5, used a medical metaphor to explain the key problem in Corinth. According to reports from Chloe's people, the church was sickened by factions and divisions associated with various leaders in the church. Paul diagnosed the root cause as a prideful desire for status and power. His prescription called for the church to focus on cross-centered wisdom. In the opening section of this week's passage, Paul explains how cross-centered wisdom understands leadership roles within the church. The idea is fairly straightforward. The work of different ministers should be seen as complementary, not competing. If this seems basic, remember that Paul has just told the Corinthians they still are not ready for solid food. This is basic. Paul uses two analogies to make his point. First, he likens the growth of the church to growing a crop. Leaders have complementary roles in the process. Some leaders may plant the crop, and others may water. But these different actions all aim at one goal, producing a good crop. Each leader's part is significant only in relation to the whole, and God is ultimately responsible for the whole, a healthy, growing church. The part each leader performs is assigned by God, and no single part is more important than any other part. In a society such as ours, where we are quick to classify and stratify people's work based on perceived importance, these basic principles are helpful reminders for our lives. Paul develops his second analogy, constructing a building, in greater detail. Through this analogy, Paul emphasizes the responsibility of the builder. Two critical tasks are incumbent upon the builder. Number one, the builder's work must conform to the building's foundation. Jesus Christ is the foundation upon which the church is built. And we know from earlier comments that the foundation Paul has in mind is the cross of Christ. Number two, the builder must build carefully, using proper materials. Paul mentions six possible building materials: gold, silver, precious stone, wood, hay, and straw. The builder needs to work with materials that will stand the test of fire. Now, Paul uses very strong words and images in chapter 3, verses 10 through 17, to emphasize the builder's responsibility. Listen to these words: fire, judgment, the day, saved, reward, loss. Remember that Paul is not addressing the fate of individuals in this section, but rather the fate of the church. While church leaders have serious responsibilities, the judgment Paul speaks to in this passage focuses on their work, not their personal fate. Paul concludes by connecting the analogy to a specific building, a temple. In doing so, Paul introduces a key idea in his ecclesiology, his understanding of the church. In retrospect, it represents a fairly radical shift in perspective. Paul believes God's presence is not found in a particular physical location, but with a people. When Paul says, "God's Spirit dwells in you, and you are the temple of the Spirit," the "you" Paul uses is plural. In this passage, the temple of God is not the individual person, but the corporate people of God, the church. This idea may not sound radical to people schooled in the Christian faith. We've been taught that church is not a building, but the body of believers. Even so, it remains tempting to equate church with building, especially in America, where being a real church usually implies owning a building, or at least being on the way to owning a building. Paul concludes this section by returning to the main point his analogies aimed to make. He once again contrasts the world's foolish wisdom with God's true wisdom. God's wisdom of the cross reverses the world's wisdom based on status and power. Christians should not boastfully lift up one leader over another. To do this is ultimately futile and foolish. In the next section, chapter 4, verses 1 through 13, Paul applies this principle of complementary ministry to his own ministry in Corinth. In moving towards a more personal response, the temperature rises in his rhetoric. We can feel the heat as he defends his own ministry and attacks those who thought they were something special. Paul's defense of his ministry relies on two key points. First, as a servant and steward, Paul's primary responsibility is to his master, not to the people with whom he works. In our culture, where the customer and customer service have preeminence, Paul's claim may sound a bit odd, but in Paul's context, no one would have questioned his claim. For this reason, Paul can basically ignore the criticism he has evidently been subjected to from the Corinthian troublemakers. Second, Paul considers any judgment made about his work to be premature and misguided, since the true merits of one's work, including the motives one brings to ministry, will be brought to light only when the Lord returns. Does Paul's line of defense apply to ministers today? Well, I once served in a church where the mission committee ended funding for a missionary because it believed the person was not achieving expected results. Perhaps this missionary could have paraphrased Paul and told the committee, "You have no right to judge my ministry. I'm doing God's work here. I don't work for you." Caution should be exercised in assuming that the specifics of Paul's defense strategy translate into a general principle of accountability or non-accountability for a Christian leader's work. It would be wrong to infer that ministers can never be held accountable because they work for God or because only time will tell. Proper systems of accountability and authority are appropriate for church leaders. Having defended his ministry, Paul now goes back on the attack in verses 6 through 13. The Corinthian troublemakers should know that pride and human achievement runs counter to God's commands. It makes no sense to boast about something received as a gift. Finally, in a moment of sarcastic exasperation, Paul takes the relative comparison being made by the Corinthian troublemakers, that comparison is, we are better than Paul, and turns it into an absolute contrast. The troublemakers are kings, and Paul and his followers are the dregs of society. This absolute contrast is shock treatment aimed at knocking some sense into the Corinthians. In the final section of this week's passage, chapter 4, verses 14 through 21, Paul pulls back from attack mode to close with a fatherly plea. He reminds them that his ministry gave birth to the Corinthian church. They are therefore his children, and he is their father. Paul appeals to them to follow his ways and the ways of his emissary, Timothy. The section closes with a fatherly admonition for the Corinthians to set matters right before Paul visits again, so that Paul's next visit will be a positive one. Let's conclude this week's Lectio with a few comments on pride, a key theme for Paul. Pride has been a consistent theme for Paul in this passage. He accuses the Corinthian troublemakers of boasting, of being puffed up, and of being arrogant. Pride's destructive effects were threatening the Corinthian church and undermining Paul's ministry. Pride has the same potential impact on churches today, especially given our emphasis on pride as a positive virtue. We often hear, take pride in your work, or you can be proud of your accomplishments. How can we keep these legitimate concerns for quality work from drifting into a destructive form of pride? These perspectives from Paul's wise advice in this passage can help us. Number one, we need to see our work as a team effort in which we faithfully do our part in the process. God, however, is responsible for the results. Number two, we need to see the work of ministry as a grace given, not a merit earned. Number three, we need to be generous in evaluating any person's ministry. Number four, we need to resist the temptation to compare our ministry with others' ministries. Number five, we need to resist the temptation to turn differences in our ministry into symbols of status. If we practice these five principles, we can value work and ministry done well without drifting into sinful pride about the work and ministry.